I'd like to thank Dr. Singh for inviting me to be part of this panel. Our next speaker is going to be Dr. Patel. He's an attending surgeon on the head and neck service at Memorial Sloan Kettering, who's written extensively on mucosal melanoma. And those of us who manage head and neck cancer patients will say that this is one of the most challenging and problematic situations. So he'll give us an update on the management. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. And thanks, Boo, for inviting me and leaving me with this, you know, last lecture in the panel, mucosal melanoma. I have nothing to disclose. We've so far heard about cutaneous melanoma, and if you look at the big picture, melanomas that arise from the mucous membranes of the body are less than 10%. In fact, just over a percent of the almost 90,000 cases of melanoma that were estimated to have occurred in the U.S. last year. Of those, half of lesions will occur in the head and neck. And so it's not an infrequent problem for those of us who treat patients with head and neck cancer. Now, when you look at the differences in cutaneous versus mucosal melanomas, apart from the rarity of the disease, there's gender differences. Females are more commonly affected with mucosal melanomas. There are racial predilections. Japanese populations are thought to have a higher incidence. There's obvious environmental risk factors differences that we'll talk about in a second, but also age-related differences. Melanomas in the mucous membranes occur in older patients, except for sinonasal melanomas, actually oral melanomas that occur in younger patients in the 40 or even younger age group. So there are obvious differences, and a lot of this relates to risk in terms of carcinogen exposure. Obviously, for mucosal melanomas, UV exposure is not a consideration. There's some thought that exposure to formaldehyde may be a risk factor, especially in sinonasal melanomas where there's occupational linkage in some European studies. Mucosal nevi do occur, and they're not very frequent, about 0.1% in the general population. But the reason this is important is basically to understand that melanocytes do reside in the normal mucosa. They're of neural crest origin, as in the skin. But in the nasal and the oral mucosa, there's a high concentration or higher concentration of melanocytes compared to some other sites. And this is why you can have a variety of pigmented lesions in the oral mucosa. Most commonly, they're intramucosal nevi and also blue nevi. The bottom line here is clinical distinction is very, very difficult. So if you see a lesion like this, you really want to consider excising it so that you don't miss a mucosal melanoma. On top of that, there are many, many other pigmented lesions that occur in the mouth or the nasal cavity. And I'll go through some of these in a little bit of detail. In the mouth, the most common cause of intraoral pigmentation is an amalgam tattoo. And that occurs from deposition of dental amalgam, typically in areas where you have teeth. So the floor of the mouth, the lower gum, upper gum, and areas in that vicinity. And they're usually very small, pinpoint, well-delineated, pigmented areas, but they can be up to 2 centimeters in diameter. And if there's a doubt, obviously you want to biopsy this. Smoker's melanosis occurs in about a third of smokers, and it's usually in the front part of the mouth, the labial aspect of the anterior part of the lower gum. And it's really just melanin deposition in the basal layer, and it doesn't really need any further workup, as does racial pigmentation, which occurs in a large percentage of African-American persons. It's benign and requires no intervention. But if you have something like this, a melanosis, it's essentially a benign lesion. Some people think it represents the radial phase of growth of a melanoma. And about a third of patients who get a diagnosis of oral melanoma will have pre-existing melanosis. So the etiologic linkage is not really clear. But if you do have melanosis in the presence of malignant melanoma, the prognosis, there is no added adverse prognostic impact, just finding melanosis. But again, here the bottom line is, if there's a doubt, biopsy the lesion. Melanotic macules occur pretty frequently in the Caucasian population, and they're small. Usually it's more because of increased melanin deposition than increased number of melanocytes, and they typically occur on the buccal mucosa as shown here, or on the vermilion of the lower lip or the gingiva. If you have a lesion that's pigmented, irregular, bleeds to the touch, and nodular, it's a no-brainer. That's a melanoma unless proved otherwise. It's also important to understand that patients with cutaneous melanoma can metastasize to the upper or digestive tract. It happens rarely. Less than 4 or 5% of patients will metastasize. If it does happen, it typically affects the base of tongue and the nasal cavity. And the period to metastasis is variable, between 2 and 7 years, and there are certain histological features of metastatic melanoma that you can use to differentiate from a primary tumor, which I've listed here. Now, within the oral cavity, the hard palate and the upper gum are the most common sites of melanoma in the oral cavity. Lips, the tongue, and other areas do get affected, but less frequently. Within the sinonasal apparatus, the nasal cavity is more commonly affected, and within the nose, it's the lateral aspect of the nose. The septum is very, very rarely affected. Among the paranasal sinuses, the maxillary sinus is the most commonly affected. The other sinuses don't suffer as much. And staging typically has been very, very simple all these years. It's the Ballantine system that was typically used. Stage one is localized disease. If it spreads to the lymph nodes, that's stage two, and distant spread is stage three. And this was the norm until the seventh edition of the AJCC, UICC staging system in 2009, when mucosal melanoma of the head and neck first gained its own staging system. And this has continued into the eighth edition as well. And in recognition of the poor prognosis of these lesions, there is actually no stage T1 or T2 for primary tumors, or stage 1 or 2 as a stage grouping. So the minimum stage that you can have for a mucosal melanoma of the head and neck is a stage T3, and if it's more advanced, it'll be stage T4. And that's a reflection of the poor prognosis of these lesions. Now, when it comes to treatment, surgery is still the preferred treatment of choice, and then you have these adjuvants, which we'll talk about in some detail. Radiation therapy, chemotherapy are the conventional adjuvants, and you just heard immunotherapy has changed the way we look at melanoma, along with targeted therapy. So in terms of surgery, wide resection with clear margins remains the treatment of choice. Easier said than done. Wide margins are very difficult to achieve because of the anatomic constraints that these tumors pose, especially in the sinonasal region. These tumors are multifocal, and there's a lentiginous growth pattern, as you saw with the skin. It's a common problem with mucosal melanomas as well, making it difficult to get wide margins as a routine. And that is why adjuvant radiation is typically used for patients who have close or positive margins, especially in the sinonasal region. And we'll talk about the results of postoperative radiation in a little bit, but conventionally, hypofractionation schedules have been popular because melanoma was thought to be radioresistant to conventional fractionation. But there are equally reports that show better local regional control with conventionally fractionated radiation. The take-home message here is, even with better local regional control, there is no improvement in overall survival with adjuvant treatment. So when you use postoperative radiation, this is Memorial data for oral melanoma and sinonasal melanoma, there's really no advantage in terms of survival, except for a subgroup of patients who have advanced tumors in the sinonasal cavity requiring craniofacial resection, where margins and the anatomy makes it very, very difficult to do a wide excision, and that's where surgery with postoperative radiation has traditionally produced better outcomes in terms of overall survival, disease-specific survival, and relapse-free survival. Radiation therapy on its own, primary or definitive radiation therapy, is an option for surgically unresectable tumors. Again, conventional fractionation has been preferred because there's a need to protect the optic or the visual apparatus. Proton beam therapy has thought to be an advantage, with complete response rates reported in about a third of patients with local control in 40%, with especially using higher dose fractions compared to conventional fractions. But this is all very, very limited data in very small series of patients, not replicated widely. Adjuvant chemotherapy on its own has a very unclear role. There's a single randomized study from China, which and the results have not been reproduced elsewhere. And in our own hands, that the objective response rate for alkylator-based cytotoxic chemotherapy is less than 10%. So the overall thought is that there's a general lack of efficacy for chemotherapy in this disease. And as was just pointed out, if something doesn't work, you try and add more of it. Combination of chemotherapy with conventional immunotherapy has had very little effect in outcomes, and traditionally has been tried because of lack of options. So when you look at results of conventional therapy, surgery with post-op RT, and chemotherapy, kind of extrapolated from the cutaneous experience, and we look at these traditional outcomes, it's striking that about half of patients with mucosal melanomas of the head and neck will recur locally. And only a small percentage of these patients can be salvaged with further treatment using conventional options. And as I pointed out before, this is because of the difficulty in achieving wide margins when you do surgery. And having said that, there's a small subset of patients where you can kind of keep them NED nibbling away at the tumor over a period of many, many years. And that's a testament to the interaction of the tumor with the host in terms of the immune system and how the host modulates the tumor. So there's a lot that we don't understand about mucosal melanomas. With nodal metastasis, it's the same thing. Oral melanomas present with nodal disease more frequently than sinonasal. You'd expect it to be the other way, but somehow nodal metastasis at presentation is more frequent in oral cavity subsites. And it has a worse prognostic impact in oral but not in sinonasal melanomas. And as a general rule, elective nodal dissection has been advocated for oral and not for sinonasal tumors. When it recurs in the neck, mucosal melanoma again has a very, very poor salvage rate as compared to other cancers in the head and neck, such as squamous cell carcinoma. And about a third to half of patients will fail at distant sites, and as expected, none of these patients using traditional treatment paradigms are amenable to salvage. The median time to death is in the 6-month range. So in our hands, this is old data, but the disease-specific survival for mucosal melanomas of the head and neck is in the 40 to 50% range at 5 years, and the overall survival is only about 35%. Dismal compared to cutaneous melanomas, where the outcomes are much, much better. So that brings me to the newer therapeutic approaches. You heard about immunotherapy. I'll spend just a few minutes talking about some of the differences which from my vantage point I see between cutaneous and mucosal melanomas. And I won't go through this whole table, but as a surgeon, it's important to understand what actionable genetic alterations and immune system modulators are available to patients before you pick up the knife and do a huge operation on patients with a disease where the outcome is dismal. So if you look at the molecular alterations in mucosal melanoma, it's very distinct, and it's very typical of a cancer that does not have a known environmental carcinogen. So compared to cutaneous melanomas, mucosal melanomas have tenfold fewer mutations. And in contrast to cutaneous melanomas, there's a high rate of copy number and structural variants. And I don't know if it projects well, but the conventional BRAF V600E mutation, which is pretty frequent in cutaneous melanomas, and you just heard about that, is actually very rare in mucosal melanomas. Contrasted to the c-kit mutation that is more frequent in mucosal compared to cutaneous melanomas. So it's really important to know that there are actionable target mutations or that can be used by small molecular inhibitors, and it's for a disease that has a potentially explosive and not so good end, I think it's reasonable to routinely molecularly profile these tumors so that when and if the time comes, you can use these targets to benefit your patient. Now, in terms of immunologic treatment strategies, we also heard that there's traditional treatments like interferon and IL-2. We don't use them any longer. And the reason things have changed is because of the new treatment modalities that have become available, and I won't go through these in any detail at all, except say that there's very little data specifically on mucosal melanomas. A lot of the literature and the options that you just heard about are applicable to cutaneous melanomas, not specifically to mucosal, but it's an extrapolation that that is easy to make when you have a disease that kills rapidly and the outcomes are really poor. There is excitement about using immunotherapy with radiation and specifically in what's called the abscopal effect, which is tumor regression at a site that's completely distant from the radiation field in the presence of immune modulation. And it's thought that radiation may enhance the efficacy of anti-PD-1 therapy in these very, very difficult to treat patients. And that's something to keep in mind when you have a patient with an intractable, difficult to treat situation. Immunotherapy has also been combined with surgery. This is a trial from the MD Anderson Cancer Center, where surgery and immunotherapy have been combined to try and potentiate the effects of surgery. This is again of note. There were no patients with mucosal melanoma in this study, and just as a testament to the toxicity of these drugs, the trial was stopped early because of two reasons. One, in the surgical arm, there was disease progression in a couple of patients that prevented them getting the surgery that they would have otherwise got. And in the other arm, there were high rates of grade 3 toxicity. So it's not as rosy as it looks in terms of immunotherapy. You want to think really hard before you put patients through these toxic treatments, especially in combination with other forms of more conventional options. Surgery will produce a CR within a few hours, I tell my patients. So in summary, you want to be aware of the types of pigmented mucosal lesions, which will help early diagnosis and guide the patient to the appropriate treatment. I hope I've showed you that mucosal melanomas are distinct in terms of their epidemiology, genetics, and immunology. Surgery does remain the treatment of choice, and you use postoperative radiation when indicated. And I do believe that molecular profiling for these tumors should be done as a routine, because eventually most of these patients will need it. Immunologic checkpoint blockage is less effective. Combination immunotreatments are result in higher rates, but at a higher cost in terms of toxicity. And there's a lot of promise in some of the new treatment options that are coming our way. So with that, I think I'll end. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much.
Just want to take a brief moment to thank all the panelists for their outstanding talks. I'm going to go ahead and open the floor for questions. If there's anyone who has questions, please come to a microphone and go right ahead. Yes, right there.
Thank you all for those excellent talks. In the absence of a survival benefit, one of the great benefits to a sentinel node biopsy is it may demonstrate patients with disease who could benefit from adjuvant therapy. Otherwise, you wouldn't have identified those patients. Most of those drugs that are approved for adjuvant therapy require a complete lymph node dissection. The MSLT trial showed there's really not much of a benefit to that complete lymph node dissection. The insurance companies won't pay for the off-label use of those drugs. So, you know, you weigh it out for the patient. If it's an axillary dissection, it's probably worthwhile. If it's a groin dissection, it may not be worthwhile. So what are your thoughts on a neck dissection, risks and benefits, and how do you go back and forth with the medical oncologist on, you know, can you just get them into a trial and treat them for free? Because, you know, there is a benefit from these drugs, but there's really not much of a benefit from the completion lymph node dissection. Vast majority of those patients have negative nodes.
It's a great question. I'm going to open that up to the last two panelists. Actually, I'm going to be a little more provocative and say, should we be doing any completion node dissections? And should we be treating patients who have no detectable disease just because they have sentinel node positivity? So the first question to Sandra and the second question to Maggie.
This is like being in tumor board a little bit. I think there's a lot of issues here to unwind. So while it is true that all of the trials that were for the adjuvant use of these drugs did mandate a completion node dissection before the use of the drugs, I will say that most of those trials actually included a higher burden of disease than what we're seeing from the MSLT and the DCOG trials. So they're slightly different patient populations, I would say. I will say that I think if you have one positive node with kind of really micrometastatic disease, I'm not clear that either is indicated, neither a completion node dissection nor adjuvant therapy, because of the really low burden of disease. I think in a lot of those patients, the sentinel node was the only place that disease was found. So it is something that we're kind of constantly thinking about. I do believe that there's some trials kind of in the pipeline where there's no need for completion node dissection before enrollment in those trials in the adjuvant setting. I don't know if you have something to add to that. I mean, this is a real kind of situation, and I think hard to answer with evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a testament to how quickly the field is moving. At the time that the studies of the adjuvant immunotherapies were designed, completion lymph node dissection was the standard of care, and so that was a requirement for getting into the studies. I will say, without commenting on arguments with insurance companies necessarily per se, that most of the patients that I treat in my practice who have stage 3 disease are receiving adjuvant therapy that the insurance company is paying for without getting a completion lymph node dissection. And that's the common practice that we've adopted. Most of my stage 3 patients do not get a completion lymph node dissection for all the limitations discussed. And many of them get adjuvant therapy, but not all of them, including some of the folks that would have fallen into that sort of very favorable low-risk category, sort of the 3As that either were not included in the adjuvant studies and or their risk is really quite low, and so therefore the benefit of adjuvant therapy is probably low.
So Maggie, just to push that a little bit further, some people say that you get the same benefit to control when the disease presents itself, as you do to when you give preventative therapy. Is there any benefit to give adjuvant therapy with all those toxicities, or do you just wait for the patients who present with disease and treat? Because the outcome is probably going to be the same.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I think the sort of million-dollar question, and the one I highlighted in my talk, and what we're waiting for is the, you know, where's the overall survival benefit? Should we give it now? Should we give it later? I will say for patients, seeing those relapse-free survivals, seeing those curves where, oh, you're telling me I have an 80% chance of recurrence, and now it's a 50 or 40% chance of recurrence, you can see the appeal. I do try to have that equipoise discussion, though, saying the caveat is we don't know how important it is to have it now versus later.
So I'm going to come to the next question. I'll just say that I rarely, if ever, do completion dissections at this point. We don't always give adjuvant therapy. A lot of it is a bit risk stratified and even more patient stratified. Observation is common in this population. And therapy when something shows up. So next question.
Thank you. I enjoyed your presentations. I have a question. So how are we supposed to follow up patients in the head and neck? Because it's very simple to do an ultrasound of the axilla, to do an ultrasound of the groin, but it's very tough to do ultrasounds that are, let's say, high quality ultrasound of the head and neck. You get all of those non-specific lymph nodes in the cervical chain. You see a 1.8 centimeter lymph node in level 2. And you're supposed to do this every 4 months if you're going to oblige by the MSLT2 recommendations. So I'm not sure that MSLT2 really applies to head and neck. Can you comment a little bit about that?
It's a great point. I will say that the debate about the nature and the quality of sonography needed for observation has been widely debated. I think a lot of sonographers are picking up that technique, and I think are getting better at it. I do think head and neck is a little bit different. I do think cross-sectional imaging at head and neck is probably better than it is in other areas. So I think there's a couple of modalities. I'm certainly not suggesting cross-sectional imaging.
So CT scan every 4 months?
No. I'm certainly not suggesting cross-sectional imaging, but I think it speaks to how it is different and how I think radiology colleagues will catch up in terms of that skill set. I don't know what, I mean, you do ultrasound.
There's a major impact of the technician or the ultrasonographer on how good the ultrasound is. We're fortunate to have some really great people, so we do rely on the ultrasound. The alternative would be cross-sectional imaging if you don't have access to an ultrasonographer.
I know we have good ultrasound, but I'm just saying out in the community that may not be the case.
Yep, very,
so how do we apply the results of this randomized trial to the community setting where you're going to tell doctors, okay, you have to follow every patient with ultrasound every 4 months? That's really tough.
Yeah, and I mean, that obviously is a broader question because a lot of things that are available in academic centers may not be at community centers, your practice has to be individualized. I guess risk stratification as to how concerned you are, and then appropriate, if ultrasound is not reliable, CT scan-based imaging. There's a lot of debate about PET. PET sometimes doesn't show up the melanomas, but cross-sectional imaging is probably appropriate. I'm going to pose a quick question to Kishwar. So Kishwar, you're doing a lentigo malignant inside two melanoma, and you now have a huge defect, and all the margins are positive. When do you stop? And I mean, that's not an uncommon scenario.
So it is very, very possible, and this is where often we try to use as much preoperative evaluation as possible. We're very fortunate to be able to use some confocal imaging to determine that, because I think some sort of realistic expectation with your patient before you start as to what the endpoint is. You can do control biopsies in areas of equally sun-damaged skin, so your pathologist knows kind of the degree of melanocytes. And then it depends on the age and their functional status. You know, if this is a late 80s, chances are that you would probably stop at that point, assuming you've removed invasive disease. You can follow it up with the Michelmod, you can observe them, but it is kind of one of those things that is very dependent on their age, their comorbidity, and functional status, yeah.
I was just going to say something about the head and neck ultrasound, something we use all the time in some places in the world. They follow their squames, head and neck squames, with ultrasound. So I think the magic of the study is the fact that it can be repeated. It's relatively cheap. It's easy to biopsy from. So say you see Mr. Smith tomorrow and he has a questionable-looking lymph node, but you're not really sure because he has some other lymph nodes. You repeat the scan in 2 months, and you can biopsy from that. It's cheap. It's no radiation. It's reproducible. So I think the magic is you're not getting a one-shot look at this. You're going to follow these patients every few months, and anything that looks suspicious, both by echo texture, size, all these things we look at, you can biopsy pretty easily. Most people will be able to be pretty accurate with a needle biopsy of the node.
I have one more question. So. Sure. When your sentinel node is in the parotid or periparotid area, I know the board answer, but what kind of surgery do you guys do to get it out?
It's a good question. I will say, if it maps to the parotid, I call my head and neck surgeon. That's really not something that I have a lot of training in, and I think I'm just being completely honest, if it's an area of risk, I usually have somebody who is available to do it. I think standardly a lot of people will just do the parotidectomy.
I think you have to understand where the anatomy of the lymph nodes is in the parotid gland. The vast majority of lymph nodes is just below the capsule of the parotid, so they're rarely deep into the parotid tissue. And so the nerve's really not at risk unless it's a very anteriorly placed node. And so opening the parotid fascia, SMAS layer, getting down and carefully looking, you can find the vast majority of lymph nodes. The technical challenge there is that salivary tissue often looks like little lymph nodes. And so it becomes a little bit sometimes frustrating maybe to get to the point where you're comfortable that you have the right node out. But the anatomy is very permissive to do that limited approach. If you just simply spread past the fascia, most of the nodes are going to pop up right there for you. Yeah, often you can get away without that parotidectomy. Chanel, any thoughts?
You're completely right, and the key is the location. If it's towards the anterior edge of the parotid, you want to be very, very careful. That's where the nerves are going to be superficial. Closer to the tragus, you're completely fine. You can't hit the nerve if you wanted to.
The one thing I'll do different if it's anterior is you can retrograde find the nerve, so you can go past the parotid, find the nerve, trace it back, and then it's much more comfortable to find that sentinel node, so you don't have to dissect out the full chain of the facial nerve. Unless there's any other pressing questions, I think we're at the end of the session. I again want to thank the speakers for taking the time to come here and for their really outstanding presentations, and I want to thank the audience for your attention and involvement.